Joining me now is Mark Thompson, a journalist with Time Magazine. Mark, thanks for joining us.
Sure, Nick.
So, for you, where did it start? Where did the inspiration come to be a journalist?
Well, basically, even when I was a little kid, growing up in Connecticut and Rhode Island, I got involved in community journalism. And after I came to BU to study journalism, I went back to my hometown of Rhode Island and ran the weekly newspaper there. The neatest thing was, you know, 4 years out of high school, going back to my old high school and calling teachers by their first name because I was now the editor of the local weekly paper. And it just took off from there.
Right. So when did you decide that you wanted to go to college, make a career out of it, and continue it to where you are now?
Well, basically, when I was in high school, I went to my local weekly paper and I said, you know, you guys have kids covering high school sports. I want to do that. And they hired me for the princely sum of $15 a week to cover, you know, high school football in the fall and basketball in the winter and baseball in the spring. And I found out that I really enjoyed it. And I started by covering sports. When I came to BU and I took some courses with George Sullivan and Jerry Murphy, both of the Boston Globe, they talked to me about actually doing fellowships at the Globe doing sports, and I didn't want to be pigeonholed. I said, yikes, my roommate is a sports writer, and he ended up as a sports editor of the Berkshire Eagle in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. But I didn't want to do that, so I wanted to have a broader scope, and so I shied away from doing sports, and although I did cover them for a while at the Free Press, that was the last time I covered sports.
Okay. And today, at Time Magazine, what do you like best about your job?
What I like best about my job is I get to fail in week one and succeed in week two. I think the essence of journalism is questing. The first syllable of question is quest. And you're always out there hunting for either the truth, the best obtainable version of the truth, the least lying version of the truth. And, you know, it's got to be that gets a reporter salivating. The notion that, gee whiz, here's this question. I really don't know what the answer is, but I'm going to take my hammer, I'm going to take my chisel and hack away at this rock and try to unveil what the truth is. And sometimes it takes a long time, and sometimes you hammer at the wrong place and don't come up with an approximation of the truth, and the next week or the next day you've got to go back and try to attack it in a different way. And it's that constant questing, I think, that keeps a good reporter alive. I think it's important that the best reporters tend to be insecure overachievers. They're never satisfied. They always think they're missing something. They always go back. And it's that sort of thing that's allowed me to be a reporter now for 30 years.
You talk about the quest. How did the quest for the Pulitzer begin? Could you tell us a little bit about it?
Well, I was working in Washington for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, which is the newspaper in Fort Worth, Texas. And I was covering the military for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. And in Fort Worth, the Bell Helicopter Company was building helicopters, the Huey and the Cobra models, which you've seen all the time in the Vietnam War movies, and which even to this day are used in the U.S. military. And I was very interested in helicopters that crashed and why they were crashing, especially those helicopters were built in Fort Worth. And after a couple of years on that job, I began to notice a distinctive pattern of helicopter crashes that all had the same catastrophic event that triggered them. That being that the rotor blade of the helicopter as it spun around would flap. And if it flapped too much, this would break. And when that broke, the rotor blades went away from the helicopter. The helicopter became a brick and crashed and killed everybody on the helicopter. After 67 of those crashes over a span of about 10 years and 250 servicemen dying, for the first time in 1983, someone survived a crash like that. And up until that time, Bell and the Army had always insisted that when this so-called mass bumping occurred, that it was the fault of either the pilot who was overflying the helicopter and doing something he should not have been doing, or that something else bad had happened and the crew was already doomed. But everyone had died, and there was no one to contradict that. Larry Higgins, a test pilot, was flying a Cobra helicopter over the Chesapeake Bay at the Pax River Naval Air Test Center when the rotor blade came through the cockpit, killed his co-pilot, and flung him into space. But unlike everybody else who had flown these helicopters, because he was flying at the test school, by regulation they had to wear a parachute. He had a parachute. He pulled the parachute and became the first pilot or the first passenger on a helicopter that had experienced this problem who lived to talk about it. When I learned there was a survivor, I spent several weeks tracking him down, and I'll never forget calling him up and was being, you know, had sort of nervous because this was a fellow who, if he said what I thought he would say, which was, dang it, I wasn't doing anything wrong when this rotor blade came through the cockpit and killed my co-pilot, it would lead to a heck of a story, especially for a Fort Worth paper. And his words were measured and slow when he said, I was not doing anything wrong that day when that rotor blade came through the cockpit. And I remember hanging up and calling my bosses in Fort Worth and saying, guys, I think we have a heck of a story here.
What made your Pulitzer piece so good, and why is it so rare?
Well, I think what makes it rare and special is the fact that basically in journalism they give out about a dozen a year. It is unlike, you know, the helicopter series was validated, to my mind, where the Army grounded many of the helicopters in the wake of our series, and beyond that, instituted a worldwide repair program to fix them all. And since then, there has not been a helicopter crash like this. But that's all good and fine, and I've had many pilots come up to me and thank me for that series of articles. What's different, though, is when you are judged by a jury of your peers, when your colleagues look over the offerings of journalism over the preceding year and basically say, you know, in the field of investigative reporting or in the field of public service journalism, we think this is the best example that's been turned out by the American press in the prior year. And so it was extraordinarily gratifying to have my work validated by a colleague of my peers.
So, changing gears a little bit, looking at the future of journalism, you know, Time Magazine now has all of its content up on a website. Do you think eventually there won't be any newspapers or any magazines per se? Everything will just be on an iPod or, you know, a wireless device, or everyone's going to be looking at it on the internet?
No, I think that the tactile sensation of having a magazine to roll up or a newspaper to fold under your arm or stick in your briefcase will remain for quite a while. I mean, I think definitely people are, you know, a generation ago, or even two generations ago, you began to see the segue of news from the printed page to television after much of it had gone to the radio. And now we're seeing a further evolution to a computer screen. But I think the portability, the convenience, the cut-out ability. I mean, if moms want to have a scrapbook in the future, they're not going to want to print everything out that they get on Google. I think rather there's something neat about the kid being listed on the honor roll in the local paper, the high school graduation, the wedding announcement. I think journalism, especially local journalism, will remain forever to a large degree on paper because of that scrapbook factor. People really like that. As you take a step back and you look at national publications or major newspapers, I mean, I think there is a sense. I mean, the world right now has far too many reporters and not enough editors. We need someone to say, forget it. You don't have to read 100 blogs every day. Here's the A section of your local metropolitan newspaper, or once a week, here's Newsweek or Time Magazine. This is the take. If you're a real busy person and all you've got is a half an hour, here's a summation of what you need to know. And I think when we're on college campuses or when we're in great high-tech towns like Boston, we get a misperception of how a lot of people do their news reading. And a lot of them don't like to sit in front of the computer screen. And while that is a generational thing that's changing, I still think there will be a substantial minority of people who prefer the satisfying thunk of that morning newspaper on their front stoop.
Right. And do you have any fears for the future of journalism in terms of either quality or its future?
No, I mean, I'm a realist here. When I was graduated from BU 30 years ago, there was a recession on, and it was tough to find a job in journalism. But the fact of the matter is that this is all cyclical. It's all like tides. For kids at BU, for kids in COM, for students at the College of Communication, you know, you hate to use the phrase content providers, but that's what they are. There is a huge maw out there just waiting to be filled by words, by images, by audio clips. And journalists are the best people to produce those things. And there will always be a hunger for those things, especially the ones that are done under the template of responsible journalism. So I have no fear for the trade, for the profession of journalism. I do think the way it is being delivered to our readers, to our viewers, and to our listeners is going to change. But the journalist is always going to be the key cog in that machine.
And the future of journalism for you, is there a big fish out there, or a big interview, or a big story you're looking to get?
The big story is always the next one, and it's tough to predict what it's going to be. Once again, I think it goes back to it's very difficult to be a good reporter and to be satisfied. If you're satisfied, you're not a good reporter. Ergo, the only story that counts is the next one. I mean, I can remember doing an awful lot of work for the magazine in the wake of 9/11, and I've sort of stepped off of that merry-go-round recently, and you're forever feeling this gnawing in the pit of your stomach, like, what's the next story going to be? And generally, you don't sort of calibrate, ooh, it's got to be this big. I want it to be this big one. You just want to go out there every day, every week, and do good, solid journalism. And the big ones will come along with the little ones, and everybody will, you know, have a mixture of those kind of stories to do.
All right. Well, Mark Thompson with Time Magazine, thanks for joining us.
Sure. Thank you, Nick. Appreciate it.